For whatever we lose, like a you or a me, it's always ourselves we find in the sea. E.E. Cummings. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support, and if you're a newcomer, welcome in. Hope you will avail yourself of our backlog of episodes, and any returning listeners, thank you guys, as always, again, for that continued support. This week, we will be kind of finishing up our study of Neolithic Greece, and then we'll be moving to the west of Greece and the Balkans to begin discussing the Neolithic peoples of the central Mediterranean Sea, Italy, southern France, eastern Spain, and the Adriatic Sea between the years of 6 to 4000 BC, BCE. And this will probably take us a few weeks to get to, as you might imagine, especially considering what we had to go through for the Balkans. But I don't think it will take us quite as long to get through that, though we will see. Again, though, I did have a couple of things to kind of finish up and clarify as we briefly discuss southern Greece. First, when I was going through Dardanus's story and discuss his meeting with King Teucer, I misspoke, and I don't think it was clear enough that Batea was the daughter of Teucer. I think what I said could have been construed that Batea was Teucer's wife. I corrected that with some text in the YouTube episode on the, you know, the picture and the screen and all that, but I just wanted to make sure that was clear for you guys who are audio-only listeners. Second, I talked about trade links between the Aegean Islands, and I think I forgot to mention, or at least wanted to expand upon, the obsidian trade from Melos in the Cyclades. And that has been found as far away as Mesopotamia in some Ubaid sites, is I think the earliest that it has been discovered in Mesopotamia. Though this trade isn't directly coming from Melos to Mesopotamia, which I think would be obvious, but I just wanted to make that clear. The obsidian is arriving at Anatolian coastal sites, where they are then trading it to their neighbors inland. Now, as time goes on and sailing technology improves, they begin exporting it to sites further away themselves. But this never stops trade with Anatolia or mainland Greece, who they were also trading with. And this leads me back to mainland Greece. Now, when I talked about the Sheshklo and Dmini cultures, I mentioned that there were also numerous small villages appearing around them. And that's true, but there are also villages appearing further south in the Peloponnesian Peninsula. I wanted to go over the etymology of the Peloponnese. This means the island of Pelops, or Pelops's island. It could be translated either way. Now, the Peloponnese isn't really an island, obviously, but in some ways it is very close. The only bit of land connecting it and the rest of Greece is the Isthmus of Corinth, or as it's usually just referred to in Greece as the Isthmus. And this is about 6.3 kilometers, which is like 4 miles wide. Now, Pelops was a Greek mythological hero who, among many supposed feats, briefly united the peninsula under his rule, and he is the grandfather of Agamemnon and Menelaus from the Iliad fame, and we'll talk more about Pelops and his family more in the future, because it's a whole ordeal, and it's very integral to Greek myth and history about themselves. But again, that's for the future. Now, the villages this far south are very typical of early Neolithic agriculture life. Again, agriculture provides most of the food, and of course herds are kept as well, though due to how hilly and mountainous the area is, cattle aren't as numerous because there's just not enough grazing land to support a huge population of cattle, so most of the herds are primarily goat and sheep. Now, of course, hunting, fishing, at least at coastal and river sites, as well as gathering, are still practiced as supplemental food sources. But most of their diet is agriculture and herd animal based. Now, some of these villages are on the sites of future famous cities in Greece, like Argos, or, you know, very near where other cities will rise up. Now, their pottery follows first the Schlesko style, and then the Domini style becomes prevalent and kind of replaces the Schlesko around the same time period that you would expect it to do based on what happened between those two sites. Now, one of the more interesting places dating to this season in the area is not a village, but is in fact a burial site. And this is at a cave called Elpotripa, or Elpotripa. I'm not quite sure of the pronunciation on that, where the remains of over 170 individuals dating between 6,000 and 3,200 BC have been found. Not to mention a large amount of grave goods like stone tools, shell jewelry, and pottery. Now, the cave fell out of use after an earthquake caused a portion of it to be sealed off. Now, there is also one example of it being used later, where in one of the more outward chambers that was not closed off, they have found a Mycenaean, it's a receptacle for bones. You would store the bones of the dead in these, and this is known as an ossuary. But this can be dated to around 2000 BC, and it appears that it was reinterred there. It was buried first somewhere else and then moved into the cave. Why that happened, we don't really know. Unfortunately, it's not any kind of name or anything on that pottery to determine who this was and why they were moved to that cave. Now, interestingly enough, the cave is also very close to a future religious or temple center for the god Poseidon called Tynaron, which was said to be near an entrance to the underworld, which lends credence to some theories that at the earliest days of the Mycenaean faith, the deities that became Poseidon and Hades diverged from different aspects of an earlier single god. But again, more on that in the future when we talk about Mycenaean religion and Greek religion. Now, we're going to go ahead and turn to the areas that we will be covering for the rest of this episode, and again, probably another few after this one. The Central Mediterranean Sea, Italy, Adriatic Sea, and coast. First, we will start with the Cardium ware culture, or the cardial ware, or the cardium / cardial pottery, or the impressed ware culture. Now, this culture exists in the Western Mediterranean, in places in southern France and the Eastern Iberian Peninsula, but they show up there a little bit later, and we'll talk about how that happens here now. But primarily, most of their important sites that we're going to go into more detail on, those are mostly in Italy, but again, we'll get into that. Now, I covered them last season because they do emerge around 6400 BC, but I will go into them in a little bit more detail now and then, again, probably next episode, too. Now, this culture will last in some areas until around 5500, so it has a good 900-year run, give or take. Their name comes from the scientific name of the shells that they use to impress patterns onto their pottery, or at least the earliest patterns that they were making. And that is the Corculum cardissa, or the heart cockle. Now, the earliest examples of this pottery style were made in what is today Greece, specifically the Grecian province of Epirus, and the island of Corfu. Now, over the course of about 200 years, they begin to expand in that region, and they establish more and more small villages until around 6,100, when over the next 200 years they begin to move north along the Adriatic coast into what is now modern Albania and Croatia. And again, these people are very coastal. That's primarily where they're hanging out. But that route is not the only route that they begin taking. About 100 years into their northern expansion, they also cross the Adriatic and spread into Italy around 6,000 BC. And from there, they begin to expand along the boot, north and south. And within 400 years, they had sites all along of Italy's coast. And that's both coasts, the eastern and the western coasts. And even from there, they begin to move along the northern Mediterranean coast, where they reach southern France, and then they begin to move down into Spain. Though they don't get that far into the interior compared to what they do in Italy. And I think the reason for this is probably the terrain is just not what they're used to. These are very sea-facing people. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but Neolithic expansion into Europe follows one of two patterns. Either they move inland up rivers, and then they spread out from there, or they will establish the settlement along the coast. And then the next generation, you probably have any, you know, your oldest kids would probably remain there, or maybe your older kids would set off early and your youngest kids would maybe take over the land. Either option could be viable. It's hard to say what, inheritance was like at this point. But they would sail just a few miles down ocean or up ocean or what have you. Then they would establish another site and they would still, have those links with the area they came from. And then the next generation would follow the same pattern. And, they don't begin to move inland until after they've kind of occupied all the good places along the coast. Now, the reason they're able to move into Italy and not, say, move as far inland along the Balkan coast is because you have things like the Starchevo culture. We talked about how the Starchevo culture does not have coastal sites. They're far from the coast. They are inland. So the Cardium culture, they're probably not moving far inland because it's already occupied by people of the Starchevo and their successor cultures. Whereas in central Italy and the south of France and Iberia, their only people they're encountering inland are the hunter-gatherers. And we'll talk about more of this later, but the Anatolian farmers who are, spreading along these routes, they are bringing in some Western hunter-gatherers, but they don't seem to be bringing as much of them in as, say, the Eastern hunter-gatherers are being brought into the Starchevo culture or the other Balkan cultures, at least not initially. I think eventually, this does change, and in some places, obviously, it's different. Some places have more evidence of intermarriage between Western hunter-gatherers and the Anatolian farmers, and some places have less of it. And that might just be due to the number of Western hunter-gatherers there are in certain areas, but it's really hard to say. Now, of course, it's not just their people spreading. They are trading their pottery. Their pottery is found, among hunter-gatherer sites on their borders. It goes back in some directions to Greece, into the inland Balkan area. So their pottery is something that is valued by a number of different people. In fact, there have been some of their pottery found even in North Africa, where they weren't living directly, but it's obviously being traded among those areas. Of course, Agriculture is showing up at the places that the Cardium pottery is showing up, but it looks like agriculture is showing up first, and then they start developing their pottery along this traditional style. Now, this style does change, and they do begin to use other objects to impress in their pottery, but initially, it's almost always these hard cockerel shells, and as time goes on, this changes. They use other material and items to impress their wear. Now, they have, again, numerous sites all along the coast, but the largest ones that come up during their time are all found in Italy. These are the largest, the most productive when it comes to manufacturing said pottery. And these are found in Liguria, which is kind of the northwest coastal region of Italy. It's kind of like the underarm of the boot, I guess, if you want to call it that. And then you also have a site in Sardinia. There are actually several sites in Sardinia that are large. And that makes sense. That's kind of right in the heart of the Cardium pottery area. And then there's also a large concentration of Cardium sites in, it's called Capa Nevagata. And this is kind of on the western coast of the boot. It's kind of the where the heel of the boot and kind of that little spur of a peninsula, which I meant to look up the name of that, but did not get to pull it up. That is also a site. So you have a site kind of on Italy's northern coast, the island of Sardinia, as well as the western, the eastern coast of Capa Nevagata. And that is right across kind of from Corfu. If you were to draw a straight line, that's kind of the heartland, or at least the initial homeland of the Cardium pottery culture. Now, this pottery didn't really vary much in terms of color, at least not that I've seen from the examples. They're almost all shades of brown, maybe some that are might be considered like a very light red or a reddish brown, but most of it is just brown. The primary distinguishing feature of this is, again, the patterns that are impressed in the pottery. Now, as they begin to move west, again, they're keeping this kind of same production method for their pottery. But once they get into France, there's not as much continuity compared to, say, the Italian sites and the sites along the Adriatic coast. It may be harder to sail west to east. I have a feeling that's part of it. But then, as they begin to move in Iberia, the Iberian and kind of French zones have a lot more similarities to each other than either of them do to the Italian sites. And then once they begin to go to the south of Iberia, there's no continuity after that, despite, again, them being all descended from the same initial stock of Anatolian farmers. And we'll talk about the sites in southern Iberia, western Iberia, in more detail later. But they are traveling via the sea in the same way. And by the year, or I should say around 5,500, they are on the western coast of Iberia in what is now modern-day Portugal. And eventually, right around 5,000 BC or so, they've begun to expand into the interior up rivers along those areas as well. And, of course, the sites in France, they had began to move in the interior in right around 5,400. So right around the time, or I should say about 100 years after the Cardium culture dissolves or breaks away, and you begin to see a lot of regional variations. And that's kind kind of what we're going to be covering in the next couple of episodes, these kind of these newly developed cultures out of this initial explosion of cardial wear sites. And there are quite a few of them. I think there's around 10 or 12, depending on, you know, how closely you consider some of these sites related to each other. And again, there's some disagreement on this, but there's going to be a lot of kind of new cultures emerging in all these areas. And even in these areas, there are, of course, even smaller regional variations. As you know, one site begins to gain predominance and begins to influence its neighbors. But that's not to say that they ever lose contact with each other. There's a very long history of sea trade among these sites, even as they developed into these separate cultures. And again, there's always the question of how closely related did these people think they were to each other? Did they keep this long-term kind of memory? Were they still speaking some type of similar language to each other as this time goes on? It's, of course, hard to say. There are guesses, but no one really knows for sure. But, you know, I think this is actually a decent stopping point. This is a little bit shorter episode than what we've had the last couple of weeks, but it kind of sets the stage. Cardial wear, again, disappears right about 5,500. It's about 500 years after our episode, or our season, about 500 years after the start of this season. And then from there, or I guess next week, we'll start covering these breakaway or further developed material cultures that arise from the cardial wear sites. And then after that, we'll discuss the more inland routes. We also need to cover the end of the Western Linear Pottery culture. I have not forgotten about them, but that is something that we'll probably do after we're done with the breakaway cardial pottery sites. But yeah, if you guys have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. I'd be happy to hear that. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter/X, or you can comment on the YouTube videos. I do see comments there, and I try to answer them as quickly as I can. But yeah. I appreciate all your support. Please like, download, subscribe, rate 5 stars, what have you, via your platform of choice. We are sitting around 360 subscribers on YouTube. We've got a huge amount of downloads from Germany the last couple of weeks, so shout out to my German listeners. I hope you guys are enjoying. I think Berlin and Weimar are showing up on my heat map on RSS, so I appreciate all you listeners from there. In the last couple weeks, the downloads have really seen a big jump, so I hope it's something that continues, and yeah, hope you all have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you're listening to this, and I will see you all next time. Peace.